I was born into a left-wing family. I was a left-wing activist until my mid-30s. Then I became a scholar of the history of the American left, and have written articles and books on that very subject. So, I have a few stories to tell, and I'm ready to share them. Please join me in a 4-week webinar on the history of the American left at Renegade University. And right now, we are offering a 3-credit course for 2 credits until August 9th. So sign up now. Go to renegadeuniversity.com/courses for more information and to buy tickets to the History of the American Left with me beginning in late August. I hope to see you in class. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. The government must always have power over your body. My guest this week explains why. This is my interview with Jeffrey Schoellenberg. I am joined from the belly of the beast, Brooklyn, New York, by Jeff Schoellenberger. Thanks for coming on, Jeff. You've now destroyed your career by appearing on this show. Congratulations, sir. The good news is I can employ you. You know, I have a school where you can teach. It's all good.
This is exciting, you know.
It should be. I discovered you, what was it? I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. I don't even know how, but I just saw you somewhere in social media, in the ether. And I just thought every point you were making was brave and pretty brilliant. And also that I agreed with it for the most part. So you have a lot to say about postmodernism. Good God, help us all. The current left, the academic left, the political left in this country. Libertarianism, very interesting critiques of libertarianism. And COVID, you've been with me. You've been this very bad boy on Twitter and elsewhere, talking about how the vaccine is bullshit and all the masking is bullshit and the CDC. I mean, so you're out there, man, and you're in Brooklyn. See, I left Brooklyn a long time ago, and I left the academic left a long, long time ago. So I can say these things relatively unscathed, but you must be getting some shit, or at least feeling some heat, or at least maybe feeling a little nervous and vulnerable. Are you?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll correct that slightly. I haven't really been I'm against generally vaccine mandates, but I'm not. I'm pretty. I got the vaccine early, and I don't have particular regrets or concerns about that. So I'm still, and my position on the vaccine has actually been that, you know, I'm not particularly swayed by these stories about, you know, side effects and so on, for the same reason I'm not particularly swayed by, propaganda about COVID itself, which is that I see it as important to accept small levels of risk. And I think if you stop being willing to engage in that kind of reasonable assessment of risk, then you start going insane, which is kind of what's happened to our culture. So I'm against the mandates for various reasons, but you know, I'm not particularly on the side. I mean, I will say that I think there good reasons to be very concerned about making children get it, because their risk from COVID itself is so low. And there's at least some evidence of concern that the risk from the vaccine itself may be greater. So, so that's kind of where I stand on that. But anyway, not to get too sidetracked, but yeah, so I would say I've also undergone an evolution, because, you know, I mean, as basically everybody did, right? In terms of all the COVID stuff, right. You know, for one thing, the politics of it weirdly flipped, last spring. And I'd say that largely had to do with Trump being the kind of, as my friend Oliver Bateman said, the sort of, you know, big orange sun around which everything revolved. So basically his kind of weird shambolic response to it, you know, created this weird set of reactions that helped bring us to where we are today. And I still think a lot of the hysteria about it, I interpret as kind of a belated manifestation of sort of Trump hysteria, because it became this kind of I think of him as this kind of scapegoat king figure who, you know, kind of brought pollution upon the nation. So the contagion of the virus is so strongly associated kind of unconsciously with the way that he sort of polluted and corrupted the nation in the view of, you know, much of our sort of respectable class. So,
you're starting to sound like who you are, which is a postmodernist literature professor.
right.
So let's introduce you for a second here, so people know what they're dealing with. So you have a PhD in comparative literature from Brown University, and you teach expository writing at NYU as an adjunct, and you have been doing basically that for many years now. So, but you're an academic, and you're essentially an English professor, right? And you teach literature, and you have studied postmodern thinking, philosophy, literary theory. And what I hear now is you applying some of that to this COVID thing and to the Trump phenomenon as well. So what I would love to hear is your explanation of how postmodernism, however you conceive it, helps you understand the pandemic and the lockdowns and the government response and the social response to this.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few different angles for this. You know, one would be through Baudrillard. The one I was just offering was more through René Girard. But, you know, in this theory of scapegoat. but, you know, another path would be through Baudrillard, right? And, you know, one of the things that most intrigued me relatively early on was this very marginal sort of, you know, nominally right-wing figure, Cody Wilson, who's mostly associated with the 3D printed gun, right? I know, had this very intriguing essay.
Yeah, I know him well. He's been on the show.
Yeah. yeah. So he had this very intriguing essay, right, about called COVID 9/11, you know, back in April of last year, where he really read it through Baudrillard. And specifically, you know, Baudrillard is usually like popularly associated with the Matrix and so on, but, you know, that's not a particularly useful way of thinking about what Baudrillard was analyzing. And as Cody Wilson shows, you know, the center of his work starting in the 70s was the sort of prevalence or dominance of the model, right? So what do we mean by the model? Well, basically the sort of statistical model or simulation, right? And so the sense in which we're living in the simulation is not that we're living in some kind of, you know, that we're actually living in a computer simulation. It's that our sense of reality is grounded in statistical modeling and simulation, right? And so the fact that our entire policy response, but also gut emotional response to COVID has been driven by this realm of modeling and simulation from beginning to end is, I think, a really good illustration of that, right? That you know, this idea that, we could compare this to 9/11, right? These moments where supposedly postmodernism is is challenged by this supposed reassertion of the real, right? Just something that's viscerally real, like a virus, right? That this isn't just some kind of language game or something. This is real. Well, it's actually not so simple as that, because the way that we apprehend this is actually through this realm of modeling and simulation, right? And that has never not been the case with COVID, right? It's been that way from the beginning. And in that sense, we are living in the simulation, in the sense that our politics and our fundamental sense of reality are grounded in this sort of abstract realm of modeling. So that was Cody Wilson's argument, and I think it's been borne out ever since then. There was this map in the New York Times the other day, which was like, one of these scary maps with lots of red on it, right? Mm-hmm. But basically it was something like a map that was supposed to represent vulnerability to the Delta variant. I mean, and this is essentially, it's very postmodern, right? Because it's essentially a completely self-referential construct, right? It's that you create this map that is supposed to represent some kind of fundamental terrifying reality. But actually, if you just step back from it for a minute, it's really just a kind of completely artificial construct, right? Which is largely or entirely non-referential, right? It refers entirely to itself. Yeah. And yet that is the grounding of not only our politics, but our sort of emotional life. So anyway, that would be one kind of postmodern angle on the COVID experience and reality such as it is. The other one would be kind of through Foucault, which is what I wrote about for American Affairs.
Right.
And would be more focused on, the way that and the irony of Foucault's status within academia as this kind of patron saint of sort of leftist academics is that, a great deal of his work was really targeting this. And, you can see how this overlap, even though Foucault and Baudrillard were sort of nemeses, you can see how this overlaps, right? Because it was really targeting this politics of expertise, right? Where something like public health becomes an alibi for a politics that is, entirely grounded in a kind of dictatorship of experts. So,
yeah, I love that. So I want to go back to these two concepts here. Let's unpack it a little bit more. Just Baudrillard, simulation, simulacrum, that whole idea. So can you sort of unpack that just in a generic sense? How would you teach just that concept in isolation, without referring to COVID or anything else, like in a classroom, the 101, Baudrillard 101.
So it's really this, it's grounded in this kind of historical account of, I guess, what we might call representation, right? And this idea that you move through different phases of representation, right? And there's a meme of this, right? That, where there's a representation that is referential in some sense.
Okay.
And then there's a representation that refers to the world, or representation that refers to some kind of model or construct of the world. And then finally, there's a representation that refers only to itself, right? This is the final phase, right? The sort of third order, or the phase of simulation, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, and importantly, it's hyper-reality. So it's not, and the idea is not simply that it's a substitute for reality, but that reality itself becomes pervaded by this logic,
right?
And so it becomes impossible to separate. And this is the logic of the model, right? Which we can think of just as, take that New York Times map, right? Yeah. Where you generate a statistical model, plug a bunch of numbers into it, and create this representation. But this representation isn't referential in any meaningful sense. It doesn't. It creates a reality rather than
why is it not referential?
Rather than referring to it.
Why is it not referential?
Well, because it. I mean, you know, if you think about all of the, I mean, you said to not, not necessarily apply to COVID, but the point would be that it functions not by representing the world, but by extracting certain ideal variables and then creating an autonomous world that functions on its own, right? And so this, so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't represent the world in any simple sense, right? It's not a map in the sense of a map that attempts to point us to things in reality. Rather, it's a sort of autonomous construct that's driven by its own logic, right? And that then that logic infiltrates reality itself, right?
So how does this infiltrate our logic? How does it infiltrate our reality? In other words, what does it cause socially?
Yeah. I mean, so it causes what's kind of interesting about it in, and you know, this isn't necessarily in Baudrillard, but in our you know, contemporary reality, as we see this kind of prevalence of the model playing itself out. I mean, I would say it causes a kind of madness, right? Because it causes a kind of incapacity to, it causes a madness in which the sort of logic of the model is it supersedes and overrides even what we might take as kind of basic common sense, right? It becomes sort of obligatory. So I would say in our current situation, it causes a kind of madness, right? And if you look at this document that like the CDC's slideshow, you know, it's a document of that kind of madness. I would say that this slideshow that just came out, it's so bizarre and convoluted. But it assumes all of these premises and then sort of fabricates this construct of reality, which then goes on to actually, you know, reshape our daily lives and the world that we live in.
What it causes socially is a mass freakout about something that you're saying the evidence doesn't support, right? That the Delta variant, the statistics on the Delta variant are still quite low. The number of cases, the number of deaths, number of hospitalizations, extremely low, tiny, tiny numbers, right? And children are still essentially immune, essentially to dying, right, from this thing or getting sick in a serious way. And yet, I can speak from experience, we know lots and lots of people in our world, by the way, in the most educated zip codes in the country, Brooklyn and Berkeley, California, right? That's where we are, Jeff. So, so there are how many professional social scientists do you think would look at that map in the New York Times and think, oh yeah, that's true. And my gosh, we better mask up the kids, honey, and get some vaccines into them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now.
Yeah.
Jeff,
no, I mean, it's, yeah.
Explain that. Seriously, explain how PhDs in social science who do this kind of thing for a living, analyze data like this, put forward theories about it like this. I mean, how is it that probably 99% of those people would look at that map and think that they have to put a shot in the arm of their child? Why is
that?
Why do you think?
Yeah.
What is it about those people?
I mean, and this, I think this is where you need the sort of the Foucauldian side of the analysis, right? Which is that, you know, they belong to a particular social class that exerts power in particular ways and maintains its status in particular ways. And so one of the ways it does that is by creating these models that can then be used to kind of reshape reality. Right. Mm. And so I think, you know, there's a way that this particular way of shaping reshaping reality is linked to the kind of power exercised by that group of people. And so, you know, they can't really see outside of it because it, in some sense, they're, you know, to the extent that they're a ruling class, or at least sort of a sort of supporting group for the ruling class, they you know, their epistemological assumptions are tied to their own status within the society. Yeah. So
they're part of the establishment, as they used to say in the 60s, which I think is a great term. Right, I mean, right. I have no problem with that. The establishment, I mean, they are literally in universities, which which receive federal funding. That's just the most obvious way in which they're connected to the establishment. But those universities have always been, they've been training grounds for the elite. That's what they've always been. I mean, still to this day, if you go to Harvard, we know that your expectation is to go run society after that.
Yeah.
And that's who's in Congress, and that's who's the CEOs are. They went to all those very important universities. So sure, I think that's right. It's their position. It's their subjectivity, as postmodernists would say, that determines their that determines their analysis in some ways, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think you can, you know, in a meta sort of way, you can also think about, you know, I wrote about this a bit last year, but, you know, there's an interesting passage in Christopher Lash's Revolt of the Elites, where he talks about, you know, he kind of roots the sort of popularization of a postmodern sensibility, right? Where you basically think that, you know, that any kind of sense of a sort of base material reality has been lost. And we live in this world of kind of, you know, signifiers, as we might say, right? Where reality is just a kind of tissue of signifiers. Yep. But basically this, this idea is rooted, Lash argues, and this is interesting because it's kind of a throwaway pat. It's not like even a significant, he doesn't even dedicate a chapter to this, but, you know, it's, he basically argues that, you know, it's completely logical that, the people who came to accept this worldview were, if you look at the material circumstances in which they existed, right, which was particularly a situation in which even before the population at large was kind of taken up in this world of information and communication technology, right? They were inhabiting this world, right? Academics and other kind of white collar professionals were inhabiting this world of computers and of communications and information, right? Before anybody else, right? And so we can take some of the, you know, part of this ideology as a reflection of the material and professional circumstances that they inhabited, right? And then, you know, then we can also take this as a sort of, I mean, ironically, because a great deal of this kind of body of theory was actually kind of targeting the sort of technocratic post-war regimes that had emerged. But, you know, it could become a kind of official ideology of the people operating in that world that in some way supports and justifies their status within it.
Right. Absolutely. And Trumpism, and unfortunately, you know, you and I are among the only vaccine hesitant, or whatever we are, skeptics, I guess, you know, lockdown skeptics, pretty much, who aren't Trump people. I mean, that's one of the problems, right? Taking our position. It's just a fact that the vast majority of people who are on our side on COVID, at least, are somehow associated with Trump, right? I mean, and Trump, by the way, and you've said this yourself, so Trump has been seen himself as a virus even before COVID came along. So it's very, it's quite ironic and amusing, right? That the two things are happening at the same time, right? We got rid of one virus, we expelled him from the body politic, and now we have a new one, but he's to blame for this one also.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, another thing I'm interested in is the whole, you know, one thing that COVID allows is for a kind of new mutation, we might say, of this panic about misinformation and so on, right? That kind of that emerged alongside the Trump phenomenon. And so, you know, part of what you see is this, I mean, you know, we have this metaphor of virality, right? That is, and weirdly, I mean, this is an aside, but you had all these bizarre, you know, articles like when COVID was spreading, where it was like, COVID spreads just like internet memes or something like that. And it's like, well, I mean, the whole point of like that metaphor of virality. So it's just this odd reversing back into the source of the metaphor. But in any case, what happened is that they merged, right? And so, you know, my opinion is that the trajectory that led to like Trump being banned from social media finally was partly made possible by these kinds of attempts to crack down. I mean, COVID provided an alibi for a much more heavy-handed kind of censorship online. And so what happened was basically that, you know, if you think about like a year ago or a year and a few months ago, you know, you started seeing this like labeling on Twitter and other sites, right? And it all had to do with COVID, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this idea that misinformation or whatever kills, right, had already been circulating, but the COVID allowed for the sense of danger to be escalated.
Yeah.
And then that, I think, was part of what enabled the justification of this, again, much more heavy-handed approach.
Yeah.
So I think that, I mean, and then, you know, interestingly, the most dramatic consequence of that was Trump himself getting banned, which sort of makes sense in that on one hand, he was kind of the original vector of this whole panic, or the original kind of prompt for this whole panic about misinformation,
right,
which then I think morphed into this panic about COVID, which became fused with that, and then ultimately led to his banning, which I doubt would have been quite as easy to do had they not already been, you know, extremely heavy-handedly taking down anything that contradicted whatever the latest, you know, system update of the consensus was. Often in ways that were themselves self-contradictories.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the use of the health metaphor by ruling elites, right? Calling things a virus, calling things that are politically dangerous viruses. You know, in the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin called rock and roll a virus because it was taking down, you know, the youth of the Soviet Union who were more interested in Elvis Presley than in Joe Stalin. So, I mean, it's common, and this is something that postmodern thinkers have noticed, right? Because they're interested in language, as are you. And so they notice the way that language and words are deployed against political threats. And that's one way you do it, right? You talk about Trump as a virus. Well, you can almost feel that because you kind of know what it means to be sick. Everyone's had the flu, right? And then you have a virus that's killing people. And it's sort of like Trump, who is killing the body politic of America.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I noticed. And then the second thing is, I do believe we are in a new phase, I think what's happening now, and I don't know exactly why it's happening now, but we are living in an age of hysteria unlike any we've seen before. Now, America is famous for its hysterias all the way back to Salem and through the Red Scare in the 1950s. But if you start with like 2011, from the last 10 years, it was the sexual assault on campuses, date rape, every woman's being raped on campuses. Then it was a couple of years later, then it was systemic racism and cops are killing Black people on the street wantonly. And then it was the Trump phenomenon, and we're going to be putting gays and immigrants and Muslims in concentration camps. And then it was the Russia hysteria. Russia's controlling our country. Putin is the boss now. and now it's COVID. It's sort of like we're in this phase of sort of like serial hysteria.
Yeah.
Like Americans, I don't know if this is part of American culture, or do you have any thoughts about that? Does that make any sense to you? It seems sort of new to me.
I mean, part of me wants to go back to 9/11 as kind of what created the mood, and then the mood continued, but then it kept grasping for new things to feed it. I don't know if that makes sense. I mean, I often think about, you know, and I do think, you know, and again, I would say I kind of evolved on the COVID stuff. Like I didn't necessarily see the response to it as dangerous as I do now. But part of my evolution was beginning to recognize the kind of war on terror, the echoes of the war on terror. And particularly the way that, you know, this idea that, and I think this, you know, in all of these kinds of panics, there's a kind of element of this, right? But if you think back to Dick Cheney's like idea that the whole idea of like the 1%, You know, if there's like a 1% chance of a terrorist attack on American soil, it has to be treated as 100% chance, yeah, right? And so that kind of skewing of risk assessment, which then becomes the legitimating argument for, you know, basically whatever elites decide, whatever sort of heavy-handed approach elites decide is necessary, and sort of propagandize the population into accepting. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was really part of where I started to see the danger, was that I saw the echo. You know, I was young and was kind of formed by like observing and reacting to what happened after 9/11 and with the war on terror. I mean, I was in New York at 9/11, and you know, I found I was definitely a more conventional lefty in some ways at that point. You know, I mean, this is one way that I haven't really evolved. Like I found that I found the response to it horrifying. I continue to find it horrifying. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I see my response to like what's going on now as consistent with that, right? Because they both involve this kind of this power grab that was legitimated by this propagandistic risk inflation, which could then become the alibi on the basis of quote unquote saving lives or protecting life or something like that, could then become the alibi for basically anything. Right.
Right.
And so, but going back to your other question, I would say that, I mean, it's hard for me not to just feel that like there was an emotional pivot that occurred with 9/11 and that set off this kind of, mm-hmm. hysteria that we've never really recovered from, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a very good, the Joan Didion essay Fixed Ideas, I haven't read it for a while, but you know, it's, I thought it was one of the good essays that kind of captured that mood shift that 9/11 brought about.
Okay.
And you know, I think it's, yeah, it's almost like there's been a, and I mean, this goes to one other point which I've kind of insisted on, which is that I find when people talk about how like new media changes things, like they overemphasize how it, I mean, the whole misinformation panic was premised on the idea that it could kind of plant new ideas in people's heads,
right?
And make them think something bad, right? But what I think is usually underemphasized is the way it shifts how we feel and how we just are, what our kind of emotional baselines are, mm-hmm. and how we apprehend and respond to whatever the information is that we're being presented with. And so, you know, I think about with 9/11, like you started having that, what was that sort of ticker tape thing on the bottom of the TV screen,
right?
Which is where you started, I remember just watching news in that period, you started to see that kind of bombardment with like constant updates and, you know, and I think that's a sort of visualization of the kind of, the way that, you know, the events as refracted through media then create this kind of, or help foment and sustain this kind of mood of hysteria. And so, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think of it as a mood that's been, that was decisively established. And then, you know, there are all sorts of political incentives as well as, you know, economic incentives for the media itself in kind of sustaining and stoking this mood, right? Mm-hmm. And so one way of thinking about it is, you know, and this is just I haven't given this that much thought, but that, you know, there is a kind of grasping around for new narratives that can be, mm-hmm. can be used to sustain this.
And the ultimate objective is control, right? Social control by the elites always? Is that always what they're after?
I mean, I tend to, yeah, I
right.
I mean, in one sense, yes, but I also tend to want to emphasize their relative incompetence in a sense.
Oh yeah,
that, for sure. Yeah. You know, that there's a, you know, and to kind of more focus on like what the emergent system is that's kind of
but
instantiated in these developments. But
yeah.
You know, that I think there's you know, and here, I mean, the 9/11 comparison is interesting, right? Because I do think, you know, it's pretty clear that with Cheney, Rumsfeld, people like that, you had a, You know, and weirdly it became like anti-Semitic to, even though Cheney and Rumsfeld were not right. Jewish, whatever, but like weirdly it became anti-Semitic to even say this, right? But like, right. You clearly had this like cadre of people who had been, you know, going through the revolving door of the sort of national security apparatus for decades, yep. And who had very particular ideas about what they wanted to do in the Middle East, right? And that they, you know, saw this as an opportunity and seized on it. Like that doesn't seem that, that difficult to support as a claim. I mean, I'm not as convinced in the case of COVID that there's as much of a clear agency at work. I mean, I think, you know, when I see what the CDC was like doing and saying this week, I mean, they honestly just come across as like fumbling idiots.
Yeah.
I mean, they really are just like clownish.
Sure.
Clownishly incompetent, except at, you know, sustaining the idea that we have to listen to them and that they're, you know, completely inept. And I mean, so I don't necessarily see it as a quite as grand of a plan, except insofar as it's a bureaucracy that, you know, has carved out a particular role for itself. And so it sustains that status by continuing to kind of, you know, maintain this sort of farcical and idiotic idea that its assessments and recommendations actually have any value.
But they do.
But which it does by stoking continuing to stoke hysteria and getting the media to aid it in that.
So stoking fear actually helps with their legitimacy, right?
Yeah.
They become the savior in that case, right? They become the father figure who's going to save us from the bad person or the bad disease.
Yeah, and you know, having a state of emergency, a sort of constant state of emergency, mm-hmm. you know, implicitly just makes the case that these kind of unaccountable agencies that are you know, completely unaccountable for anything that they've done, like that there's literally no way to hold them to account. They're the same, basically roughly the same people under Biden as they were under Trump. You know, there's literally no way to hold them to account for their obvious ineptitude in all of this. But that's kind of the point, right? Because as long as you maintain this idea that there's this clear and present danger, then, well, you can't, you know, you can't allow people to decide whether they think this bureaucracy is actually effective at what it claims to do, because that would, you know, that would allow these lunatic anti-vaxxers to have a say and or whatever, you know.
Yep. So Michel Foucault, you raised him also as who can help us understand this. And you wrote a wonderful piece about that. I think that's actually when I first found you. On Foucault several months ago, right? Foucault and COVID and the lockdowns.
Yeah.
Let's say, and I know you just introduced the thesis before I jumped in here, but let's do that again. So tell us about, so Foucault's written a lot about health, mental health, and the use of health language to essentially, you know, regulate, control, manage populations, right? That's the shorthand. So yeah, break that down. Tell us how Foucault helps us understand this thing that's going on all around us.
Right. So, you know, what he's doing is sort of an analysis of, and a great deal of his writing from the beginning is focused on these kind of health professions and institutions, right? Mm-hmm. And what he's identifying is a sort of paradox in the sort of political dispensation of modern society, right? Which is that, you know, ostensibly we're enjoying these rights that have been enshrined as, you know, God-given or natural, right? By, in the U.S., the Constitution. And so ostensibly this grants us this kind of freedom and autonomy that we didn't enjoy in earlier, more,
right,
you know, authoritarian societies, right? So this is the basic, you know, kind of Whiggish understanding of how modern history mm-hmm. operates, right? So what Foucault is doing is showing that alongside this history, you have this kind of shadow history, right? Which is the emergence of these exceptions to that set of freedoms and and liberties that is often created by these kind of expert professions, right?
Like,
and so,
like the asylum, like the
a clear, right, exactly. Yeah, so a clear example of this would be what happens with insanity or madness, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, something I've been interested in and also written about is like the history of schizophrenia. So one interesting thing is if you look at the history of like the famous, the kind of historically significant and well-known schizophrenics, basically all of them were just, you know, heavily focused on trying to get out of a sort of permanent confinement, right? So if you look at Daniel Paul Schreiber, right, who was kind of the great modernist schizophrenic who Freud and Jung wrote about and so on. Hmm. You know, he writes these amazing memoirs, which are this kind of bizarre visionary account of his hallucinations and so on. But the function of them is to make the legal case for his competence to live free and not just be confined against his will permanently, right, in these institutions. So, you know, so madness is a crucial case because it carves out an exception in which people can just be deprived, you know, adult human beings can be deprived of all of their liberties and right. permanently confined in modern societies, right? Mm-hmm. So how does this work? Well, it works because you have this expert class which is empowered to make decisions for these people who are defined as being incapable of autonomy, right?
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is kind of what comes out of Foucault's earliest work. And then, you know, more broadly, he explores it in different dimensions, right? He's also interested in like how even in the earlier sort of modern era, you had like the emergence of public health authorities. And like during the French Revolution, you had people who were pointing out already that there was something threatening about the fact that you had these public health authorities that could, you know, then as now say, oh, there's like a plague afoot, so no one can leave their house, or, you know, there's a curfew, or, right? So, and that these public health authorities were not subject to any kind of democratic control, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea that public health has always exerted this this potential to basically undermine these modern values, right, and has of sort of freedom and autonomy and individual rights, has kind of accompanied the modern world from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, you know, without getting too deep into the, you know, the different, the sort of evolution of Foucault's ideas on this, you know, then in his later work, he gets interested in this concept of biopower and biopolitics,
right?
Which is basically the idea of a kind of power that is exerted directly on the humans as biological beings, right? And so this, so as soon as you start having governments that, you know, are interested in, say, just a simple example, right? The governments like in the 19th century start studying the birth rate, right?
There you go.
And saying, okay, and this is a topic that's relevant today, right?
Yeah.
They start studying the birth rate and saying like, okay, well, we need a certain level of reproduction in order to maintain the workforce, right? Or else the economy will be adversely affected, right? And so we need to study what these factors are that affect, that cause the birth rate. But then we also don't want the birth rate to go up. We don't want the poor people to have too many kids because then that'll create all of these social problems, right? So when government starts saying, okay, we need to like study the factors that will help us keep the birth rate at a desirable level, right? I mean, that's biopolitics in the sense that it's power exerted directly on the kind of biological processes of human life. And Foucault's argument is that this is a distinctly modern kind of politics, right? Yep. That that it, you know, if you go back to, if you compare it to like the Aristotelian understanding of politics, where basically humans as biological beings are sort of bracketed in the political realm, right? And politics is something that concerns humans as rational beings, right? Rather than as you right. know, rather than basically as animals, right?
Right.
And so, you know, again, you can see how this is potentially at odds with you know, various other modern values, right? In fact, mm-hmm. you can see this today, right? It's like people want to think about, having children or how they raise their children as a matter of their individual prerogatives. So I think when they hear governments talking about wanting to kind of manipulate that process, then there's a kind of, or not for everyone, but for many people, there's a kind of aversion to that, right? It feels at odds with what we take to be our sort of freedom and individual prerogatives.
Right.
So I think, you know, these are kind of the themes that Foucault is exploring. It seems obvious why, you know, they would come into play over the past year and a half. And then in the article, the basic point I was just trying to make is like, it's completely bizarre that, you know, a thinker as influential as this in academia, like, doesn't seem to give anybody in the sort of academic left pause about any of what's been going on.
I know.
Like, that's pretty much the simple version of
I know. Comment.
So, yeah.
What are we going to do? So, yeah, the biopolitics of discovering the correct birth rate, right? The most advantageous birth rate for a nation state, right? That happened in the 19th century, right? That one of the things that led to, maybe this is the main thing it led to, was the promotion, really enforcement of the nuclear family as the model, right? So the federal government, the state government, all governments cracked down in all sorts of ways. Didn't just introduce incentives to get married, but made it very difficult to live as a non-married person, right?
Yeah.
And we can talk about the Mormon wars. This was part of it, right? That's why they cracked down on polygamy, right? Because the extended family, right? That's what immigrants bring here. And the problem with the extended family, it's many problems, but one of them is that they have too many damn kids, right? And they run amok and they're poor. And because, you know, so now.
And also they're harder to regulate, right?
Yes.
This would also be a way of thinking about, you know, a sort of traditional kinship-based societies, right? And I think like the most familiar version of this is like mafia movies, right? Where you see a conflict between a sort of political order that is still governed by kinship relations, right? Yeah. And that has to come into conflict with the modern state, right? That these two things cannot not really coexist, because and you see this in the mafia movies, right? That in some sense, what's bad is not so much just that, you know, these people are killing each other or whatever, or running drugs. What's actually bad is that they're doing it in such a way as to undermine the authority of the state and create this alternative locus of authority, right? Which then is represented as corroding the power of the state, because of course you have the dirty cops who get kind of kickbacks from deferring to the family and so on. That's that's part of what biopolitics has to do, right? It has to find ways of undermining the kinds of alternative authority that might emerge out of family networks rather than extensive kinship networks rather than kind of coming top down from the state. So the nuclear family is the kind of perfect subject of state power, at least in that phase.
Now, all this sounds very left wing, right? You and I sound very left wing right now. All these analyses sound very left wing. We're going after the government. We're going after the nuclear family, right? And yet, as you said, the left doesn't want to hear this. And in fact, when we bring this up, they call us Trump supporters.
Yeah.
Right. That's what it's so. And here's why, Jeff. Here's why. The establishment of the expert class that Foucault talks about, that you mentioned, right? That happened in the 19th century, right? Doctors, psychiatrists, and then their allies and government. Guess who that became, right? That was the progressive movement. In this country, that was the progressive movement. That this is books and books and books have been written about this. All the books on progressivism in the United States talk primarily about the establishment of the professional classes, the expert classes, right? Starting in the health professions, but going all the way, all across all the professions in this country, anything that requires a license, you can look back to the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century to find the origin of that. That's when they introduced all this stuff to keep out the rabble from the medical profession or the psychiatric profession or whatever profession, the academic profession. So, and the progressive, and that of course became where almost all the left and certainly all the left-wing thinkers in this country went. They went into those professions. And so, of course, this is, I'm just reiterating basically what you've been saying, right? Of course, they can't throw stones. They live inside the house. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's fascinating. It's a brilliant insight. And again, this is so left-wing. We're talking about the establishment, the institutions that are at the foundation of this society that the left seems so critical of. Well, we're saying these are the institutions that are the foundations of the damn thing, and you won't look at it because you're in it, because you teach at Harvard, or you're a psychiatrist in Berkeley, or you're, you know, like you're something, right? They're all credentialed, the left-wing thinkers at least.
Yeah.
So I, yeah, it's fabulous. That was a great, great way to use Foucault and to explain this. Let's talk about you, and let's talk about punk rock. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Good. Uh-huh. So you have a history with punk rock, right?
Somewhat. Yeah. I mean, just as a, you know, just as a fan and somebody who, I guess, you know, when I was younger, I felt like I experienced like the last era when it was at all vital, which would be kind of the mid to late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there you could still go to these older clubs in the East Village. And, you know, I mean, it was definitely already on its way out, I would say. But, yeah, you know, that you could still sense the vestiges of it. And yeah, and then all of that, I mean, I remember also another thing that, you know, here's something else I've thought about recently, which is smoking. So I mean, I smoked in high school, college, then I quit, but
okay.
You know, after I quit and recently, like I don't enjoy the smell of smoke or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I have come to see that. I mean, I remember when smoking was getting banned in New York and, you know, one place after another, you couldn't smoke inside anymore. Then you couldn't smoke outside. Like I remember that whole process. And for the first part of it, I was still a smoker. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that really does seem to me like the beginning of the end now, even though I don't necessarily want to smoke again ever again or anything like that. Like mm-hmm. It really does seem like that was in terms of this kind of safetyism and securitization and
right. These
kinds of, propagandistic risk inflation
mm-hmm.
techniques that we see today. Like it really does feel like that was when it all went to hell. And I associate that with this punk rock moment, which you, bring up because I remember just being in these incredibly smoky clubs.
Right.
And like, I remember going to one where you would, you know, at the end of the night, I remember in the winter, it would be like they would open the doors for people to leave and you'd just see the smoke billowing out in these like torrents.
Yep.
And, you know, people would go out. It was like midwinter and people would have their shirts off and stuff. And you'd go outside shirtless and there would just be this like stream of smoke coming out. And, you know, that that definitely feels like an almost impossible kind of scene to imagine today.
Right.
And so yeah, I mean, I do, I've thought back to that era more recently just because it does seem like the last moment, and particularly, you know, I'm like, here's another, just, without wanting to go down too many tangents, but here's another point that I've made recently. You know, it's weird that like on one hand in this past 10 years or so, you've had this kind of nostalgia industry for like the old New York, right? Mm-hmm. And you've had all particularly the late 70s, you know, repeatedly, you know, the moments of like the bankruptcy and, you know, the blackout and all of that, like repeatedly represented in this kind of somewhat glamorized way, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everybody loves Patti Smith and her recollections of that era and so on. But you know, what's interesting to me is that with the COVID stuff, I mean, you know, you had people, I mean, nostalgic for that era, partly because like it was grittier and more real, but also because it was like cheaper and the idea that you could just be a kind of bohemian layabout in that environment was like more feasible, right?
Yep.
But what's interesting to me is like, you know, in some sense, COVID did, I mean, COVID was like pretty horrible here, but it did provide it has provided kind of glimpses of that. And yet the people who would have consumed all of that content, you know, they don't actually want that at all. You know, they don't want to return to kind of grittiness and danger.
Right.
Right. Because they're terrified of even the slightest risk of getting this mostly non-lethal virus. Right. Yep. They don't actually want that. They just want to consume these kind of glamorized, idealized images of it.
Of course.
But, you know, there have been these kind of hints of like a return to this more punk rock kind of era of, you know, greater risk. But, you know, the very people who would wax nostalgic about that 5 years ago, they don't want anything to do with it. They want, they want total safetyism, right? Yep.
They want order and safety. Yes. Mm-hmm. So you were, so you got into punk rock when you were like a teenager?
High school. Yeah.
And where were you, where'd you grow up?
I was in Westchester, like in the suburbs outside of New York at that point, but so I was, you know, going into the city on weekends for shows and things like that.
UGBs?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what were your politics then?
It's weird. I would say I was kind of like a performative tanky almost. Like I really liked the sort of,
for those who don't know, that means a militant communist.
Yeah. And I would say like my, if you actually asked me what I thought, I mean, I had like, you know, dabbled in a bit of Marx and stuff by then, but I think I was more just captured by the aesthetic of it. Like I enjoyed the kind of Soviet, like I remember buying all there. I think at that time there were all these stores that popped up in New York that were like selling the kind of old Soviet, you know, the sort of refuse of the collapsed Soviet Union.
See that?
So you could buy the
right there. There it is. Mm-hmm. Soviet avant-garde, 1920s. Yep.
Exactly. So I really like that aesthetic, but yeah, I would say my politics were pretty, not particularly well defined.
Well, sure. You know? I mean, you were a teenager. I can't.
I was a teenager, but I like to at least pose as a radical. I would say I like to at least pose as a radical, but.
Yeah.
I don't think I had a very clear sense of what that meant.
And you was your communism a revolt, a rebellion against your parents at all?
Not really. I mean, I remember actually my parents bought me that, you know, that like graphic book, Marx for Beginners.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I remember my parents like buying me that when I was 13 because I was like expressed a curiosity about Marxism. They're like, oh, you might find this interesting. So
they helped you.
So no, they weren't particularly, you know, they didn't see it as much of a problem. I would say it, you know, in the context of the 90s, you know, it did, I think it felt like a kind of punk rock aesthetic because it, I think just, I mean, on one hand, it was definitely nostalgia, right? So it was this
communist nostalgia.
You know, paying a kind of tribute to this this lost dream of the past, but at the same time, it felt, you know, it felt like a way of being sort of anti-America in some sense, right? Of being kind of just rejecting the dominant values of the society, which, if they were anything, were certainly not communists. So yeah, I don't know. I'd say it was in retrospect pretty confused, but I definitely liked the aesthetics and would kind of claim to, would sometimes like claim I was a communist or whatever. I was also, I remember, I mean, I did read a lot about like the history of communism in that period. Like I was curious and interested. Mm-hmm. And I remember in my like history classes, you know, that being like one of the main things I was interested in, just reading about like the Soviet Union and and all of that stuff. So I don't know, but yeah, again, it was pretty inchoate and not particularly articulate, but
well, then I'm just trying to get a sense.
It was more a gesture.
You know? Yeah. But I'm trying to get a sense of sort of where you come from, right? Like politically, intellectually.
Yeah. Sure.
Were your parents like sort of mainline liberals?
Not quite. So, I mean, my mom was kind of a weird, I don't quite know how to define her. I feel like if I start talking about her, it'll go on forever because she was so complicated. But yeah, she had a lot of, I mean, so my parents read The New Republic, interestingly.
Really?
Yeah. And I'd say that, although I definitely have my, you know, I can see there were many problems with that publication. I would say it defined a certain kind of contrarian liberal sensibility that I still have some appreciation for.
I can see that.
And also that I really, you know, I remember reading the book reviews, like in the old, you know, Leon Wieseltier back section.
Yeah.
And finding those, you know, as far as writing went, you know, I'd say some of those book reviews were like, you know, really electrifying to read in that period. So, you know, if I had to summarize it, I'd say they were like slightly contrarian in some ways. And my mom was more contrarian in some complicated ways. I don't know how much I want to get into because it's so...
Okay.
It brings out so much, but so they were definitely contrarian in some ways. Okay. And I'd say the simplest way to define the kind of contrarianism that I inherited from them might be like, you know, the New Republic at that time, I just remember being the place that would publish the kind of takes that were more that were kind of cancelable within the mainstream liberal sphere. So I think they did kind of expose me to that in a way that was salutary.
Maybe you felt liberated to be contrary because of them, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see that. So, all right. So then you went to Sarah Lawrence College or university, SLU, right?
College, college.
Oh, it's college still. Okay. They haven't been promoted.
SLC. Yeah.
SLC. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a famously former women's college, extremely liberal, extremely left wing. It's kind of a classic example of what we're talking about here. So what was that like? And where did you go politically?
Well, I should say, I mean, my dad was and is a professor there. So I had that kind of odd way that I was already part of that. I was kind of already part of the Sarah Lawrence
community
from childhood because I grew up around the campus and stuff. But in any case, yeah, so... It's weird. I mean, there was definitely a very interesting sort of cohort of older professors there. And I'd say they were probably the people who influenced me the most. And I'd say they were kind of old school, not entirely, but many of them were kind of old school Marxists. And so, and almost all of them have passed away at this point. But yeah, I'd say you know, I wasn't engaged politically with any kind of campus activism or things like that. Particularly, I was like pretty academically focused. And yeah, the people who influenced me the most intellectually were these kind of, I mean, there was an older generation of faculty at Sarah Lawrence who were basically hired, you know, back in that period of expansion. And most of them like didn't finish their PhDs or, and didn't have much of a scholarly track record because they, you know, Sarah Lawrence was a place that just emphasized teaching. So they didn't really have to. And so, but they were brilliant. I mean, they were absolutely brilliant people. Just, you know, completely, you know, idiosyncratic. And they weren't, I think partly because a lot of them were not particularly like involved in scholarship. They tended to just have very individual sensibilities and not really give a shit. And so, you know, there were just a few people I studied with there who really, again, with this somewhat heterodox, like old Marxist kind of perspective really, you know, shapes a lot of my thinking.
Well, the fact that they didn't get PhDs, right, suggests that they're not fully institutionalized. Maybe that's why, that's the value of them. They weren't fully institutionalized.
Totally.
They weren't part of the establishment.
And it was just a place that had a weird, you know, it, I mean, despite the things you brought up, you know, it I think had a certain kind of tolerance for sort of heterodoxy for a long time. That
really?
I don't want to say to what extent that's true today, but probably to a much lesser extent. But also the people who, you know, get jobs there today are also more professionalized, you know.
Yeah.
The people back then were kind of these like wild eccentrics who, you know, were just kind of hired through this old boys network, you know, which obviously had its downsides, but it did mean that I think people could get hired just on the strength of somebody who is already teaching there getting a call from somebody they know at another institution just saying, hey, I have this grad student who's a total genius.
Yep.
And I think will be an amazing professor. So maybe you should give them a job. And they did, you know?
Yeah.
And so, so there wasn't, that there, I mean, and, you know, interestingly, so the person who's most associated with the sort of post-war Sarah Lawrence is Joseph Campbell, weirdly.
Oh, right.
You know, he was the most, by far the most famous professor.
That's right.
You know, and he was an odd figure in that he was something of a reactionary in many respects, but, but, you know, became this kind of beloved figure through the like Bill Moyers series of, of sort of liberal PBS watching Americans, you know? But so it did, you know, it had, a lot of weirdos and eccentrics who were still there when I went there. And that was probably the thing I most benefited from.
But you became a man of the left, correct?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, again, you know, I'd say a lot of my, whatever my sort of teenage flirtation with Marxism and so on was then, you know, kind of intellectually filled out by studying with these like old lefty professors. And then, you know, again, going back to, I mean, so around the time I was finishing there was 9/11 and, you know, the beginnings of the war on terror. And I'd say that was kind of where I became or started to become, I mean, I've never been like particularly an activist, you know, I've like gone to protests and things like that in a haphazard way over the course of my life. But, you know, I became much more self-consciously political and on the left, I'd say, in response to 9/11 and the sort of beginnings of the war on terror.
And you voted for Bernie, right, in 2016?
Yeah.
And enthusiastically, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's very much a man of the left. That's very much a man of the left. But it seems like since 2016, you've gone through an evolution. Is this right also?
Well, you know, it's always that question of whether I've changed or they've changed, you know, but yeah, I mean, I've undergone an evolution. Definitely. I mean, I think I've just gone back to, reconsidering a lot of fundamental things.
Dangerous.
You know, I'm also like, in some sense, not like I'm interested in whatever ranting about stupid CDC policies and stuff, but I'm not particularly, I guess, you know, something that happened to me after 2016 was like, I became just less interested in partisan politics and, just more convinced that it's like a boondoggle and a waste of time to really expend much mental energy on it, except as a kind of bemused observer of the circus, you know? So yeah, I mean, I'd say I became, I mean, two things. One, I just became more convinced that a lot of what people get incensed about is kind of a sideshow and is not really a good use of my intellectual energy.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, I also became dissolute, you know, I wrote for various, you know, the kind of nascent lefty magazine world of the sort of 2010 to kind of post-Occupy moment, I guess. I mean, I wrote for a bunch of those magazines and was, I never really like wanted to hang out with those people particularly, but for various reasons, but you know, I wrote for some of the magazines and I guess to that extent was kind of part of the broader, you know, supposed like renascent left of that post-Occupy moment. And then which culminated in, you know, which went from kind of the failure of Occupy to the, you know, Bernie campaign in 2016. And, you know, I joined enthusiastically in that. And I did see it as an opening for a kind of politics that I was glad to see returned. And, you know, in some ways I'd say that politics wasn't even particularly, I mean, kind of going back to my family, you know, like half of my mom's side of the family were kind of like old Union Democrats, you know, kind of Rust Belt people. And, you know, I really just saw it as like, you know, that kind of politics had been so off the table for my whole conscious political life. And suddenly you could at least, at least advocate for that stuff, you know, which I recognize was not even very radical, but it still seemed refreshing to just be able to say, yeah, this neoliberal, you know, third way shit is a total failure and a dead end. And we need to regain just this, you know, more class conscious material, you know, kind of materially focused politics that mm-hmm. once was kind of the bedrock of the Democratic coalition, you know? So I think at that point I saw that as a good and salutary thing. And I'm not sure I don't see it that way now, but what I would say is we have to think about why that failed, and specifically why it failed to create the kind of coalition that it claimed to be trying to create. Mm-hmm. And I'd say the answers that I would give to that are extremely damning to, you know, much of what, you know, calls itself the left and aligned itself behind that
Let's hear movement. It. Let's hear it.
Well, just that it really is it is a class project, but it is not a class project for, you know, like down and out people in the Rust Belt, be they Black, white, or whatever, mm-hmm. right? It's a class project for basically people like me, right?
Yes.
And it's driven by, you know, and this is again a kind of returning to fundamentals. Like, I probably just had to think about like where my own political motives and sensibilities were coming from, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think it's driven by the particular status of a certain kind of urban middle class aspiring professional in the current panorama, mm-hmm. right? Which then gets kind of projected onto this
yes.
largely fantastical
yes.
working class with which it largely has no real
connection
or ability yes. to appeal to. And yes. so, you know, and whatever, on one hand, like it's understandable people have their, you know, individual and collective interests to look after. But what I can't really deal with anymore is the dishonesty of it, like it's all this kind of pretense of standing up for these people who you actually don't really, whose interests you don't really know much about or care much about. And that just seems, you know, like a fundamentally dishonest way of of defining your politics. So I'd say that's kind of where my disillusionment is.
Yeah. Well, they're dishonest, but they're also verging on totalitarianism, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay. mm-hmm. Is that a fair term to use with the Democratic Party now?
I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into terminological debates, but certainly let's say authoritarian, right, in the sense of being explicitly about yeah. Right. about maintaining and expanding kind of unaccountable power mm-hmm. again of this essentially kind of professional expert class
yep.
and legitimating its ability to kind of dictate, you know, made sort of vast swathes of life for the majority of people on the basis of these kinds of, I mean, on one hand, kind of hysterical moral panics, but that are grounded in these kinds of, you know, this, I mean, again, this kind of statistical modeling, which becomes the sort of perpetual crises that are used as alibis for this class, the power of this class. So,
yeah. Well, they're actually suppressing speech through their proxies mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley, right? Direct.
Yeah. Not,
it's almost direct. I mean, And people don't know this. It's quite something. There are now 500 political prisoners in this country. Mm-hmm. They have mm-hmm. literally rounded up people who were at the Capitol doing whatever. We don't even know what they're charged with. And mm-hmm. but it's pretty clear there's no way there were 500 people who were doing violence at the Capitol.
Yeah.
Many of these people, if not all of them, are simply there because of their politics. And that seems really clear to me. And no one cares because they're bad people because, you know, and
yeah.
these are people who I have nothing to do with. Like, they're completely mm-hmm. different than me. I very different values. They're into God, country, the military, closing off the border. These are things that are anathema to me, but they're still political prisoners, which is something that we haven't had for a while in this country, not in this scale anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a campaign to actually directly suppress people with the power of the government. It's really astonishing. That is this a sign of desperation on their part? Because mm-hmm. that's a desperate regime would do that. These people obviously have no power. They have zero power. Why, you know, these rednecks in Florida or something who went to a Trump rally, you want to put them in prison? What are they going to do to you?
You know? Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some sense it does point to the weakness of this regime, right? That it has to do stuff like this and that it has to magnify the risk of an event like January 6th rather than giving a realistic account of it. Yeah, it does seem like a recognition of illegitimacy and a kind of, I mean, in you know, that we could think about it in terms of like Gramscian hegemony, right? That like there's sort of this idea that, you know, hegemony is how you exercise power through a kind of subtle persuasion where you kind of you persuade the majority of the populace by subtle means that your power is legitimate, but without directly saying so, right? And so you have these kind of legitimating narratives that underpin that hegemony. And I would say that this class, you know, its hegemony is under threat and is weak in various ways. Mm-hmm. And that even though there are, you know, I think it recognizes that, and, you know, the Trump era kind of repeatedly underlined that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it has to kind of lash out in order to, and I'd say the way that it does that is ultimately kind of delegitimating as well. I mean, going back to like the 90s, right? It always struck me, you know, when I was starting to think about like Marxism or communism or whatever, right? It always struck me that, you know, I remember first coming into contact with these like socialist and like communist groups, you know, these kind of ragtag little, you know, sects of, of, you know, these kind of laughable, like
I've been there,
ineffectual groups. But, you know, it always struck me that like back then that, you know, there was obviously no need to suppress these people because it was clear that like they're never going to be political prisoners. They're never going to be, because it's actually more effective on the part of power to just ignore them.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And so the fact that it's not doing that with these, you know, with something like QAnon, let's say.
Yeah. Right.
Seems like, you know, it reveals its own insecurity in its hegemonic status.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you became disillusioned with the left, but you didn't become a libertarian. You want to talk about why you did not become a libertarian, Jeff? You're supposed to become a libertarian when you leave the left. Why not?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, you know, I've become more sympathetic to, I don't know, maybe on a cultural level, I've always been libertarian in the sense of being anti-censorship and things like that. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I think that that dimension of libertarianism, I think for me, just proceeds from the idea that, you know, even if we accept the, like in recent years, you know, most inflated accounts of risk from certain kinds of speech or whatever, or quote unquote harm, right? Even if we accept that, then, and which I don't, but I don't necessarily dismiss those arguments completely out of hand. But I think that, you know, entrusting people with deciding what that harm is and thus deciding what can and can't be said is more harmful and dangerous than any such harm. Like, so that, I suppose, is a kind of libertarian argument that, you know, that I think whatever the version of liberalism that I grew up around seemed to largely accept that. So
Right.
The sort of old ACLU liberalism.
Right.
And, and of course being in, you know, being a teenager in the '90s, I was very anti, you know, Tipper Gore's censorship and you know, didn't want those parental advisory explicit lyrics on my, you know, CDs and stuff like that. Right. Mm-hmm. So that kind of libertarianism is like something I've never really swerved from. And it's just been interesting to see how much of what calls itself the left and liberalism has basically completely abandoned it. And so that's been interesting. But as far as broader libertarianism, I mean, I guess I could, you know, as far as the free market side of it, I'm still way too deeply influenced, not just by Marxism, but by, you know, people like Karl Polanyi and a kind of substantivist economics, right? I can't really take the idea of a free market particularly seriously because I think of it as a political project that has a specific history. And so I think if there's anything that just on a gut level turns me off intellectually about libertarianism, it's this idea that there's some kind of natural status quo of the free market, which you know, functions except when interfered with by some kind of outside authority. Whereas, you know, again, this is like someone like Polanyi, you know, the argument I've always been convinced by is that the free market is actually itself a radical political project, right? Indeed. Which has to do with disembedding economic activity from, you know, larger spheres of cultural and social life and, you know, unleashing it as a sort of autonomous sphere of activity, which can be separated from those things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think there are arguments to be made about the benefits of, you know, allowing markets to operate in particular contexts or whatever versus how you regulate them. But just that entire worldview is very alien to me in terms of how I was sort of shaped intellectually.
It sure is.
As far as the economic side of it goes. So I don't, and beyond that, you know, I think it just, this idea that, you know, I will say, by the way, that, you know, I think people like Hayek, I'm not particularly like well-versed in Hayek or von Mises or anybody like that. But, you know, I think they are people who people who are not libertarians should engage with and should take seriously. Yep. Right.
Yeah.
But just on a basic level, I've always found that kind of assumption that the free market represents some kind of natural state of things, which needs to be just left alone to be at odds with my basic understanding of sort of history and society.
There has never been a free market. Come on, people. Yeah. I mean, we know from the Enclosure Acts in England, right? It began the very, very beginning. This is, by the way, the best piece of evidence, I think, for the left against sort of the free market claims, right? The Enclosure Act is out, jumped off, right? They kicked people off their land so that they could build factories on the land and then employ the kicked off peasants, you know, as workers now. That's, you know, and ever since then, of course, even libertarians agree with this. You know, there's been heavy regulation by the government in all sorts of ways over this thing called the market ever since its creation, which it was a creation. It was a construct. It was a social construct, a cultural construct. And you're also saying it's a political construct. I mean, governments literally decided where the factories would be put in Massachusetts, right? Back in the 1830s. You're going to go there. You're going to go there next to this stream. You're not going to get a factory. You are. Our friend is. It's always been created by the ruling political elites in where capitalism was established in Europe and in the United States. So I think it's an important point. Now you can still though say, I would prefer for the markets to be freer than they are, meaning like you can be really concrete. I would prefer that, you know, the regulation banning, the sale of health insurance across state lines, which is ridiculous, you know, should be eliminated. And that would be, that would make health, the healthcare industry more of a free market, just freer, right? And so that's where I am on that stuff. But yeah, it's a damn, it's a damn fantasy, the free market, the free market.
Yeah, I mean, right. And I've always, I think the, that, you know, obviously the healthcare debates were central to the sort of Bernie movements and things like that. I do find that also just another example of where I find certain libertarian premises like really weird, because if the way to solve social problems is to, give people choice through the market, then that doesn't help me very much if I've just been hit by a car. Choose which hospital. I can't do a study of the different hospitals in the area and make an informed consumer choice about which one to go to
in that moment.
So there are these, there are these fundamental things that, that seem to be that, you know, it seems like there are clearly areas of life where the model of kind of consumer choice makes a lot of sense, right? As a way of resolving certain problems or of addressing certain social needs or situations. But it seems like there are also pretty fundamental ones where it does not, right? And probably healthcare is a particularly strong example of that. And then there's also the kind of information asymmetry thing, right? Where, I mean, I remember literally, like, for example, I had a health problem. And I remember the difficulty, like I realized, like I went to a hospital and was like completely, I was on a shitty Obamacare plan with like a high deductible at this point, which sucked. Mm-hmm. Absolutely horrible. But I remember realizing that this first hospital I had gone to had just like massively overcharged me for a couple of tests and procedures, and then like trying to shop around, like telling my doctor who had sent me to that hospital, like, I cannot go there again because I cannot afford to go there. Like, you need to refer me somewhere else. And just like the incredible difficulty of that process. Right. So anyway, I mean, that's like, I guess I did have that experience of like having really shitty insurance for a few years and realizing, you know, the claim behind these high deductible plans, which Obamacare of course introduced, but I mean, those were the kind like promoted and favored by free market conservatives for a long time. And they do suck and are horrible. And just, I mean, I'd like, cannot find myself in agreement with anybody who thinks that that's a good way of doing things. But
yeah, most libertarians would agree with you though on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But
I mean what I'm mainly saying is like, it's true that there was a long-term policy agenda which the Heritage Foundation and other kind of free market think tanks saying that like, oh, we need these like high deductible plans so that people have skin in the game.
Right. True.
And then Obama, of course, in all his wisdom, you know, embraced this approach, somehow thinking that, you know, delusionally that this would get the Republicans to vote for his plan, which, you know, I mean, that's a whole other source of disillusionment is like, just my personal experience with how much that, you know, landmark Democratic policy is just a complete and utter disaster. And I'm not, you know,
100%.
I mean, I think in certain ways it definitely made things far worse. So
100%. Yeah, we agree. And I think libertarians would agree with you on that too, but there is no true libertarian, right? Just like there's never been true socialism in the country. Anywhere in the world, I mean. So I want to say, man, this has been really fun for me. And I've been talking about this stuff, God, forever and ever, all the time, postmodernism and politics. And I just got a lot from you. It was a lot of clarifying stuff here and a lot of very useful stuff on how postmodernism actually can be applied in useful ways. And I think that I hope that people listen to this, and I hope that they now can see sort of new ways in which it can be very useful. And most importantly, it is really a politics of liberation, don't you think? Politics of personal liberation. I mean, that's to me where Foucault and all these guys, Lyotard, Derrida, but especially Foucault, I mean, I think they would never call it this, but I think most Americans would see it as sort of an individualistic freedom that they're pushing at the end of the day, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would you buy that?
Yeah, and I mean, in a way, that's the irony of, conservatives and sort of centrists seem to see them as these like dangerous Europeans who are bringing this European sensibility. But, you know, one thing that's kind of interesting is that all of them, I think, were chafing against the, bureaucratic, technocratic, centralized functioning of post-war European societies, right? And, you know, where I would say Foucault can be understood as a libertarian in certain respects. And so it's interesting that that is so poorly understood, both by his admirers and his detractors. I think, what's ironic about a lot of this stuff is that it, it is critical of the very kind of milieu and institutional structures into which it's been absorbed. And so I think this is the way it can kind of be read against the grain of how it's usually been read in this country. And, different ideas can be, and different conclusions can be drawn out of it.
So. Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. Man, thank you so much for this. This has really been a delight, and I think the audience will appreciate it too. I hope to do some more work with you in the future. I really like
it. Yeah, great.
Cool. And now that you're not so happy with academia either, maybe we can work something out with Renegade University at some point.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. I've been doing some outside of academia teaching already recently. So,
oh, good.
I taught this course on Rene Girard this summer, through Justin Murphy's system, if you're familiar with him. So,
okay.
So anyway, I'm increasingly, bullish on,
this is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.